Hi.
Hello, Catherine.
How are you?
I'm great. I'm in Stavoren with you. You're not 9 hours earlier. You're on my time zone.
Thousands of miles away. Yes, this is a very unusual recording where we finally get a chance again to talk like it was intended to.
We persuaded you as you fly back and forth in Europe to stop by.
Yes.
Yes.
But do you know where I'm coming from? Where did I stop by from?
Well, you were in Florence, and then you went to Warsaw, and then you came here, right?
Yes, it's Florence that I want to talk about. Yes, Florence is.
So today's podcast is on Florence.
Right, so let me start with the fact that Florence is still amazingly beautiful, even though in this post-pandemic period it is less crowded, which is something that I'm definitely not complaining about.
So I have to say that going to Florence and doing what you did in Florence had to be more fun without all the crowds.
I wouldn't go as far as saying that there are no crowds, because there are crowds at museums simply because museums had to limit the number of visitors per hour, so to sometimes like 25% capacity. And even though a lot of tourists from other continents, let's say, you know, from Asia or from the States, did not come because they couldn't travel, a lot of Europeans have rushed in on the basis that, well, finally we can just get into the Uffizi, so let's just pack the kids, load the car, and drive across the border. And a lot of that has happened. So there are still crowds, but they're kind of relaxed crowds of people who are not coming on buses, on, you know, those huge groups that basically once they come into the
museum.
You don't
have the tour groups, right?
Yeah, the tour groups change the dynamic, especially in the museum, because an influx of, you know, 50 people hell-bent on taking selfies of themselves in front of a painting that you were just trying to see. So it's a different dynamic. This is small, you know, family groups of people with their kids sometimes explaining the painting or something to their children.
That's a more intimate crowd.
It's much more intimate, much more relaxed, quieter. It's a lovely time to actually go through very popular museum sites. And since Florence, as most people know, is, you could just call it one big museum. Because wherever you stand and wherever you walk, Florence is it. Florence is a museum. Inside, outside, whichever way you look at it, most places in the old town, wherever you stand, you probably can see the dome of Brunelleschi's construction. So you always know that you're in that city, no matter where you stand. It's the highest point in the city.
So it's higher than, there are two big towers, but it's the highest, the dome.
Yeah, the cupola is the highest and the most visible, I would say. So yes. So all I'm trying to say is that it is still the place that is amazingly beautiful and untouched and needs to be visited at least once in a lifetime, if possible, and revisited as well, because it's just, the charm does not go away. But
now, did we go to Florence during the year of Da Vinci?
No, we were in the north.
Why didn't we go to Florence?
There's always either the lack of money or time or people or something that prevents.
But I can't believe we didn't go to Florence.
Well, there's something that could be always rectified one day. But at the moment, I have gone there to revisit all places and seek little treasures and things that are maybe less obvious than the Duomo that is in the middle of the city.
The way you described it to me was coffee, gelato, museum, coffee, gelato, museum, coffee.
Yes, that is my system for places in Italy in the summer, that if you want to visit something and still have the stamina to do the two or three museums a day that I usually tend to do, that's my system. First you have a little espresso, then you have a little gelato, and then you go to a church or to a museum, and then you start all over, and you keep doing it all day long.
I have to say, Florence is always breathtaking. It always takes my breath away when I see it. It's the, you can feel something. So it's Tuscany, right?
Well, A, it's in Tuscany, which is one of the most gentle and alluring parts of Italy. That basically, right. Italy is like France to me, meaning there is really no ugly or bad part of the country.
Yeah.
These are two countries in the world that I really would be very hard-pressed to say, oh, yeah, there's a bad part of it. There isn't any.
Right.
And this is probably one of the most beautiful ones within the country that is all wonderful.
Right.
So that's one thing. But actually, when we were talking about Florence, you have discovered a few things about the history of the name and the Florin coin that is associated with it. So maybe we can talk about this too.
Yeah, so with. So Da Vinci was from Florence. And I always associate the Renaissance that came out of Florence to be associated with double-entry bookkeeping.
Double-entry bookkeeping. Can you explain to people who are liberal arts majors?
The Medicis were the patrons of the arts, right? They were Da Vinci's early patrons. And their success as bankers in part related to the creation of double-entry bookkeeping. So the Florence was at the heart of creating double-entry bookkeeping, and Venice was at the heart of creating the insurance industry. And together, that was part of, you know, a financial prospering that really then supported the arts. And so to me, the Renaissance, you know, there was a financial story behind the blossoming of the arts. And it came through the Medicis as the bankers.
To backtrack to the history of it, in the 1300s, there were several families in Florence that have made a lot of money through wool trading.
Right.
Because Florence was the center of wool production, meaning they would purchase wool all over Europe, and then they would have the monopoly on dyeing it, especially in the
red. So did they do textiles, or they're just trading the wool?
They would transform the raw wool that would be purchased even in England. Then it would be shipped to Florence. It would then be dyed and weaved, especially into the color red.
Right.
Because for that you need alum, and for that you need to have access to
the source of it. Yeah, it was the cardinal red.
Correct. Which, you know, and they traded with the East. England did not. So they would transform the raw wool yarn into felt, red, beautiful red felt woolen cloth. And then they would ship it back to various countries with which they have traded, including England, for example. So that was the source of wealth. And that was going quite well until 1348, when the plague came into Europe, first to Venice and then into Florence. And for example, in Florence, out of about 80,000 inhabitants at the time, 50% were wiped out.
Wow.
So you go from a city that is kind of very vibrant and very strong to a city that's basically decimated and not functioning at all. So what happened is that those early families that made money have basically disappeared. They've been decimated and they went bankrupt. And into that void, economic void, if you like, came the Medicis, alongside with a couple of other families. I think the Alighieri and the Pazzi, for example, were other families, but the Medicis came out on top. And that's the beginning of both the Renaissance and the power of the Medicis. But they were no longer into the wall,
right.
They were into banking. And right. Now you can talk about that.
Well, one of the things that's interesting, and I don't think most people realize how far their reach was along the Silk Road. So 2 years ago when I was in Bangladesh, I went to a historical site where it's basically a town with house after house, and they all have the Venetian syndicate symbols on the front.
Oh, amazing.
And it was all Italian merchants, mostly Venice, but I'm sure Florence too, who had these palazzos in the middle of this beautiful jungle in Bangladesh because they were trading all along the Silk Road. So their reach across the Silk Road and into Asia was very, very deep and very developed even at that time. It's quite amazing. Anyway, but one of the things that financed the Renaissance was the florin. Florence minted the florin and in the late 1200s before the plague, but then it really caught on. And it was from the, you know, if you go to sort of look at the history from the time currencies were, coins were first introduced, it was the one that really first blossomed and became the equivalent of the early reserve currency in Europe. So for a couple hundred years, the florin was the, you know, the dominant coin currency in most of Europe, and it was gold. And very beautiful. I mean, that's the thing. When you look at a florin, you realize, wow, what a coin.
And it would have the design of the lily, right?
Fleur de lis.
On one side, and I think John the Baptist on the other side. But it would be called florin, but not all of it was minted in Florence.
Right.
You know, it was basically the versions of it were minted for hundreds of years all over Europe.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
But it is one of the exchange currencies
right.
that was extremely popular for hundreds of years, right?
Right. So let me just read. The Florentine florin was a coin struck from 1252 to 1533 with no significant change in the design or metal content standard during that time, which is quite remarkable. That's quite remarkable. Anyway, so...
Yeah, it's 300 years.
So it was interesting. We looked it up. Florence was created in 59 BC by Julius Caesar. And so we're looking at the meaning of the Latin word, and it meant flourishing and flowering, blossoming and prospering. And all those names fit Florence so perfectly.
And still do to a certain extent. You know, within Italy, we know that Milano is the place that is, you know, in the north and is always the center of business. It's close to the Alps. It's close to the northern countries like, you know, Austria and Switzerland and Germany. And it has its own character that is very kind of, I would say, businesslike, right? Then you have Rome that is the center of Roman Empire and the center of country, and it mixes the business and governmental institutions. And of course, you know, there is art and history and a lot of it, but it is a large place. And then you have something that is just suspended in time and is devoted to art. I mean, there is nothing much else that you can do in Florence than walk around the streets.
Coffee, gelato museum.
And just look at the art. So for me, it's the candy store. You know,
so I just have to tell you, should we do it now or do you want to wait till the end? There was a story about Florence that I didn't know until you came from Florence. So you told me yesterday about Da Vinci.
Well, this is the story that is going to appear in the upcoming Food for the Soul. So that's what we were talking about it. To make a very long story short, Leonardo da Vinci at some point was commissioned to paint a wall in the city hall with a painting that's called The Battle of Anghiari. While the commissioning council has also tasked Michelangelo to paint the opposite wall, this is the only time that the two giants of Renaissance art have been kind of working on the same project together, if you like, not necessarily together. Michelangelo was supposed to paint another famous battle, Battle of Cassina. This is all great, but Michelangelo did the sketch, and then he was called into Rome to work on a tomb of the newly elected Pope Julius II. So he just left the project and left and said, forget about it, I went to Rome. Da Vinci was working on the Battle of Anghiari, did the drawing, but then he started experimenting. Mm-mm. He wanted to take over in the story. But so he started experimenting, and basically he used, again, oil paint and the wax-based pigments, even though he was already past the experience of trying to use this in the Last Supper, that did not work out very well, but he still kept experimenting. The stuff was not drying out properly on the wall. Then he had an idea that maybe if they put the candles underneath, it's going to dry out faster, but if you put something warm underneath the wax paint, you know what happens? The stuff starts to
melt. So he destroyed his own mural.
Yeah, the whole thing was just messed up. And then he decided to forget about it and left in disgust and went to Milano.
But wasn't that the first time he left Florence. I mean, he grew up in Florence. He apprenticed.
He's been going back and forth because he was always pursuing commissions, you know, assignments. But I think that was the last time that he was attempting any project in Florence. I think that was it. That failed project was, he left in complete disgust, never did it.
Now, when you see pictures of the Medicis and Dante wearing this kind of cardinal red, is that because of their leadership in the textiles?
No, I have a feeling that, you know, Florence was famous for that
red,
that they knew how to create much better than anybody else, because you need alum for that. And they had the access to it through the Eastern trade, and the rest of Europe did not. So that kind of red was very famous and very much sought after.
Right.
Plus, it looks great on a painting, so I don't think it's anything
so
else.
So what did
that.
You see in Florence?
What did I see in Florence?
Yeah.
Well, other than the fact that Florence obviously has those incredibly wonderful museums, such as the Uffizi, which is the oldest gallery in the world, and the Palazzo Pitti, which is kind of depository of a lot of art amassed by both the Medici and subsequent generations of collectors. A lot of this art is actually on the walls because these are frescoes. So if you go from one church to the other, you can just see incredibly beautiful art that is not even paintings.
But it looks like paintings.
Well, they are paintings, but they are in a different medium. In other words, they have stayed in Florence. Exactly. They were not taken away. I mean, one of the most beautiful places that both you and I love so much is the chapel that was a Medici's private chapel. It's in a Palazzo Medici Riccardi. And it's called the Chapel of the Journey of the Magi. I think that's the translated title. That was painted by Benazzo Gozzoli as a kind of for the private viewing, and is the parade of the Medici figures and a lot of people from their immediate surroundings from their court that is painted as a travel of the hundreds of people through exotic landscape. They have not yet arrived at the manger. It's not the adoration of the Magi yet, because they haven't arrived at their destination. They're just traveling, and there's this like cavalcade of horses and people and cheetahs and hunting scenes and everything, you know, hundreds of them with beautiful horses and gorgeous colors. You can just stand there and look at it and look at it forever. That's the beauty of it. I mean, Florence is just packed with places that every single one of them has something famous in art history or something that is alluring to look at that you just need to pick and choose. You know, I don't know what
How
your experience
is. How in the world
do
they protect them? How do they maintain them over the years?
Well, one of the good way of protecting something is when stuff is painted on the wall, because it's very hard to cut out the wall and transport it through the Alps. So in a way, a lot of Florence has been saved by the fact that these were frescoes and not paintings.
Right.
A lot of wonderful Renaissance paintings are now dispersed into galleries all over the world just because, you know, a painting is extremely portable. But there is actually a woman to whom the world owes a huge debt. The Medici's family has been progressively throughout the 16th and 17th century kind of diminishing in stature and becoming less and less prominent. To the point that there was, by mid-1700s, I think, there was a last of the Medicis who hasn't even survived his wife. His wife, who was then technically an inheritor of all the Medici wealth, has made a will in which she has donated everything that belonged to the Medici, all the art, and on the condition that it may never be dispersed and taken out of the city of Florence.
Oh, wonderful.
Which has protected Florence from the fate of many other places in the world, where when the 18th century British collectors and 19th century American collectors came to Europe having much more money to spend, the Florence treasures were not taken out of Florence.
They're
because
not
that
available.
Was protected. Yeah, they were not available for sale, so to speak. Which is why now we, in 21st century, we can go to Florence and see the stuff on the walls of Uffizi, or Palazzo Medici Riccardi, or Pitti, or any other museum, because it's there. It's not only the frescoes, but also the paintings are there.
So this really was a great woman.
She was an amazing woman who, you know, preserved the wealth of Florence for the Florentines. But actually, in her will, this is what my article is going to talk about. She even mentions the foreigners. She says, and also for the enjoyment of the foreigners. This is her will, you know, which is now 250 years old. And, you know, she was already thinking of visitors, of the ones who were coming and doing the fell selfies right now, which I find amazing. So it's another woman who has saved the art, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
When you were in Florence, which has been a while ago, and you have probably
it's a long
to go
time
here,
ago.
What did you like there?
I love the towers. I love the architecture. That's what most, you know, that I remember.
The Giotto Tower?
Because this is a terrible thing to say, but when the time I was in Florence, I didn't go to any museums.
Mm-hmm. You were obviously not into that at the time.
No, we were kind of tearing through. But what I remember most was the architecture.
Well,
so,
it's in your face. I mean, what other city you have that you can actually... I mean, there are cities like this, but not that many that you can actually sit in a roadside cafe, so to speak, and in front of you there's going to be a wall of the Duomo, you know, the marble is right in your face.
But
the
it feels that
everywhere.
It's when you look at the dome and you look at the two towers, it just feels like you're there. You're back there. It feels... You just feel a connection to hundreds of years ago. You
yes.
don't feel, I don't know how to describe it, it's the field. There's a field, and you can feel that field. That's what I'm most, and I associate it with just looking at the architecture. And
yes, because the walls are still the ones that, you know, whatever Brunelleschi has built in mid-1400s to early 1500s, it's still there. It's the same stone. They have recently, actually, I don't know if you know, they have recently figured out the way of cleaning the marble from the residue, from mold, if you like, and bacteria.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
They found a bacteria that actually eats the other bacteria.
Really?
Leaving the marble clean. There is a chapel in the Church of San Lorenzo, it's called the Medici Chapel, always worth visiting, which when the later Medici's, not the Lorenzo, you know, the Cosimo, the first one, and the Lorenzo the Magnificent, but the Medici's, you know, a couple of generations later, when they really became kind of the official rulers, you know, the princes, they were no longer just, you know, the wealthy merchants who were helping the city to function, but the ones who just became princes and called themselves princes. They decided, obviously, not only they have the wealth, but they also need to have a nice place for burial. So they built this chapel, which is filled with various beautiful statues and lots of marble. A lot of it is unfortunately a little bit of kitschy, but there is a side to this chapel that actually has Michelangelo's sculptures. And the Italian scientists have figured out the way to clean those statues by using the bacteria that eats the other bacteria, the mold that is on it. Because it's impossible to clean it out otherwise.
One of the things that always astonishes me about Italy is wherever you go, wherever I've been in Italy, you are surrounded by this incredible architecture and art and beauty, and the Italians just seem to take it all, you know, it's just all part of how the world is, you know, that their world.
Because the Italian world is full of
beauty.
Beautiful
right.
Signs, full of beauty.
Right.
I mean, look at, if you walk down the Italian street and you look at the purses and whatever, it doesn't matter what price points, you know, purses, clothes, whatever, You may not like it. It may be not for you, but it's still a very beautiful design.
Right.
It may not be practical, but it's beautiful.
Right.
It's not
but one
the
of the things I've never understood was why, you know, America has copied so much from Europe, you know, so you can get an espresso, you can get great pasta, you can get French cuisine, but they never copied the idea of making your cities beautiful.
Because if you walk through an average, you know, American town, the amount of ugly buildings that are everywhere is enormous, right? The
mm-hmm.
majority of buildings, unless there's something historical or something extremely modern built by an important architect, the rest is fairly ugly. You know, it doesn't have any design behind it. So if you grow up in that environment, it shapes the way you look
right.
at the world in general, right?
Right.
The Italians grow up, you know, if you're Florentine, right, and you grew up in the shade of the Duomo, everything else that you look
everything is beautiful.
Yeah, but everything afterwards, if it doesn't look like the buildings that you grew up with, where every single little, I don't mean the Duomo, but any building in Italy,
right.
you know, in any street, you know, it will have the nice architectural designs on some building. If you grew up with this, everything else, if it doesn't look like this, then you reject it. You just look at it and you don't want it. So
you're going to write two columns about Florence.
Yes.
Because you did so much when you were there. So the first one, describe the two.
The first one is going to be called Cerca Trova. I'll explain in the article what it's about. But it's basically about various little stories and details, things that I have kind of rooted out that are not about the things that every tourist always encounters, meaning I cannot talk about the Duomo or the Uffizi in general because every tourist goes there and this is something that people are quite familiar. I was trying to find little treasures, little gems of Florentine experience that are not entirely obvious so that if someone goes there or reads about it, they can just pursue little less known facts. So that's one story. The other one is about more about paintings, but it's called Faces of Tuscany and it's
mm-hmm.
about faces in paintings that I have seen.
So I had one friend in college who criticized my art taste by saying, oh, she's the kind of person who'd always have, you know, she'd always want a painting of a little boy on a pony. And so you just sent me the most magnificent young boy on a pony. Actually, it's a full-blown horse.
Yes, the page.
From Florence.
From,
who's that?
Well, that is...
Is that from the parade with the cheetahs and everything?
That's the
yeah.
journey or cavalcade of the Magi from the chapel of the Medici in
Are you
going to
have that in the article?
Well, there are other things in that chapel. I was most attracted to cheetahs, but
uh-huh.
You have to read the article to find out about the cheetahs. Cheetahs in Florence.
Uh-huh.
That's what I'm usually after. Those little unexpected things. You just walk through these wonderful places. You look at something and then it's just like, did I see it right? Was there a cheetah there? Why is there a cheetah there? So things like this. And I think we have come to the end of our little chat about Florence.
So the moral of the story is everybody should put Florence on their bucket list.
Well, yes, the problem is that traveling is a little bit difficult. But, you know, eventually it is going to change. Eventually people will travel and probably there will be some sweet spot, maybe hopefully next year, where the tour buses will not have restarted yet, and the cruise ships. And Italy could be visited without, you know, these enormously discouraging crowds. And Florence and, you know, Venice or whatever, but definitely Florence should be the first stop for anybody who gets to Europe. I mean, forget anything else. Just go to Florence first if you can.
But I will never forget my emails from Florence. Coffee, gelato museum. Coffee, gelato museum.
That's the only way to get through it.
It does. The gelato is incredible in Italy. It really is.
See,
okay, well.
Another thing that is wonderful there.
Okay, well, it's been wonderful to have you in Stavoren. Tomorrow,
it's wonderful to be here.
We have something exciting to do.
Yes.
We're going to the Rijksmuseum.
Again.
Again.
to look at the Night Watch again.
Again. Okay.
But it has changed. That's why we have to look at it.
Yeah. As far as I'm concerned, you can't go to the Rijksmuseum too many times.
Exactly.
Right.
Thank you very much, Catherine.
Well, we hope we inspire you to check out, wherever you are, there's a museum. Go check it out.
Exactly.
It's food for the soul.
Bye.